Are you an early stage founder revolutionizing the future of retail? Then you're in the right place. My name is Sapna Shah, and I'm an angel investor investing at the pre-seed and seed stage in retail tech, e-commerce, marketplaces, and consumer. I'm also the founder of RetailX Series, an ecosystem to help early stage founders in the retail and consumer sectors. RetailX Series includes events, a YouTube channel, a Slack community, resources for founders, and this podcast. In this podcast, I interview founders, investors, and experts in the retail space, and we dig deep into the tactics around key topics that early stage founders want to hear about. Welcome to the RetailX podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the RetailX Series podcast. I'm your host, Sapna Shah. Today's episode is all about building B2B partnerships as a startup. Our guest today, Tricia Goyle, founder of Break the Love, will share her perspective on how she closed partnerships with marquee brands early in the life of her company. Welcome to the podcast, Tricia.
Thanks for having me, Sapna.
Great to have you. I'm so excited to have this conversation. So let's just start with some background. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what Break the Love is?
Yeah, so Break the Love is an online marketplace that connects people with basically recreational racket sport activities across underutilized spaces. Prior to starting the company, I used to lead digital product at ESPN, Giphy, and the Huffington Post, and really passionate about bridging the gap between online and offline communities with Break the Love.
Amazing. And so tell us a little bit more about when you launched and how long you've been in business with Break the Love.
Yes. So we launched in 2019 and we, since then, so now it's been, a few years now since we launched. And just in terms of the growth, I think for us, we've always been a little bit more iterative over the years to get to this point.
And in that time, how many rounds of fundraising have you been able to do?
We've done three rounds, an angel, an institutional pre-seed, and then a seed.
Amazing. And I guess this is where I should let the audience know that I'm an investor in Break the Love. So some of those questions are like gimme. Okay. So one of the things that I think was so interesting and one of the reasons I invested, honestly, is that you've been able to get bigger brands that are well known to consumers to partner with you from even the earliest days. And most startups have a lot of trouble doing that, right? They're so small and they go after a big brand and they get nowhere with those brands, particularly at the stage you're at. I mean, you haven't raised like a Series B or C, you know, you're not that big of a team. So I guess walk us through maybe your first B2B partnership and how it developed and what stage you were at and all the steps in the process.
Thanks for that. So just to take a step back, in terms of our platform, we started off as a direct-to-consumer booking platform. That's how we started. Our bread and butter was how do we connect people to access, right, tennis courts and pickleball courts, and basically these like recreational spaces, given that over 80% of the supply market for us is offline. So we started with building our technology during our angel round, essentially, and being able to get, essentially for us, suppliers, i.e. courts onto our platform. But on the flip side, with the marketplace, you basically are always in this chicken and egg situation where you need to have enough supply and enough demand for the marketplace to work. So we always, throughout the journey of building the company, have always toggled between making sure we have enough supply, making sure we have enough demand. When we started getting a lot more supply, we started thinking about, hey, like, how do we gain essentially more demand in a cost efficient way, given that to the point of being an early stage company, we couldn't burn cash essentially on traditional like paid marketing channels. And what was interesting is that initially we did a lot of growth hacking, Facebook groups, and different kinds of like growth hacking means that were really grassroots in terms of getting our community to get our first 3,000 users into the platform. After that, we needed to really grow at a faster rate, given we were bringing a lot of courts onto our platform. So that is when we thought about partnerships, because we saw that there were adjacent brands like recovery brands or hydration brands or apparel brands that were to make people want to potentially come to our platform to either experience that brand and or just gain access to the offering that we had on the platform. And so our first partnership that we ever did actually wasn't with, for instance, Wilson or an Amex. It was actually with a smaller brand that had an interest in tennis. The founder had an interest in tennis. And we basically just connected on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn for us has been a tactical, really powerful tool. He connected with me. And then I decided to do an outreach back to him about seeing if there's a way to collaborate on some level of a campaign that involved utilizing one of our core partners. And that partnership for us, it was micro. It wasn't like a real revenue line. It was really for us, the intention and the goal was for user acquisition was the first time that we experienced, oh, this is what a partnership can look like in our business. It can be a lever to drive right end user acquisition for us. And these are the ways that we can integrate them through our email newsletter, through our social media, and through our website, and through product sampling. And we realized that those are the four components that were valuable to that company, for instance. So I think for us, when I think about like a tactical tool and thinking about partnerships is one, like really understanding why are you trying to do a partnership? Is it revenue generating? Is it for user acquisition? Is it just for brand awareness? I think that is like the first most important thing to figure out is like, why are you going to do a partnership? And two, actually not going necessarily after the largest partner, because usually when you are striking a partnership, there are deliverables that you need to give to that partner to be a value-added partner conceptually. And starting with kind of a growing brand is actually a really great move to do, because you can work out all the kinks of what it means to be a good partner, given the resources that you had at the time. It was just myself and our two engineers, and that's a pretty tight, lean team to have to deliver on partnerships. And that would be like the first two things I would think about is like, why? And then not necessarily go after a list of your tier one, but almost think of it as like your, what are growing brands that have some adjacency to your community or to what you're building that can find value in that. Once you do that, I really think LinkedIn is a strong tool. In general, a lot of founders of these companies or partnership leads, those kind of, those two titles of a in a company are usually the ones to go after. Just sending a message saying, hey, would love to learn more about your company. Here's what I'm building, and would love to see if there's a way to collaborate. I think that language feels really synergistic. It feels like something that could potentially add value to a partner, especially in the earliest stages when you yourself don't have a ton of traction relative to a series, to your point, B, C, D company in your category. So I think really using the word of the language of collaborating, partnering is a really strong way to do so to get initial call. So LinkedIn for us is that channel that we use really.
And so let's just talk about the kind of the flip side of that. So you reached out and said, let's collaborate. The brand said, okay, let's collaborate. And you had a conversation. Why were they interested in working with you when you're a team of three and you're really small?
Yeah. So a big thing for us whenever we would have that initial conversation is we would be really consultative and share first what we do, right? Who we are, what we do, and our mission. I think the mission for us was really big to explain, because even if we didn't have a feature or something that a brand or a company wants from us, by explaining our mission, it opens up the world of possibility of, oh, you might prioritize that thing that the company or the brand might want that doesn't exist in the market. And so I think that was a big key when pitching myself and the company was, hey, like, this is what we do right now, and this is our mission and vision. It's almost like a pseudo investor pitch a little bit. And then from there, asking, hey, what are your goals? What are things that you need or you want? What has worked with other partners and what hasn't worked with other partners? Because then you're able to come back with an offering that's meeting in the middle between what you want and need and what they want and need, essentially. So I think taking a really consultative approach when talking to a partner is key in order to get them to partner with you, if you really want to partner with them. And also it's a really good filter as well to identify whether it's even worth your time to partner with that partner. So when doing those initial conversations, there were some partners when they explained what their goals were, it was like, wow, like, they are not going to be a fit in driving the additive value that we need, which is like end user acquisition. And so, you know, that's like at the time. And so like that for us was pretty also helpful for us. It's almost like it's like a two-way filter, because no partnership I've seen has really worked when just one side is gaining a lot and the other side isn't, conceptually, even back in our angel round all the way to now, actually.
So how did that lead that first partnership? It sounds like you had a lot of learnings. How did that lead to the partnerships with Wilson and Kith and a whole host of other brands that were much bigger?
Yeah, I would say that inherently by working with the first few smaller brands and companies, we basically had case studies to show a Wilson. Even though they were small brands, we were able to take these smaller brands and create case studies of what the offering was and what they gained. So we really worked hard to make sure that those first few were like the goals of that partner were met, basically. We could have one, either a renewal, and if not a renewal, if it's not a right fit, a long-term fit for you with that partner, a case study that you can take to another, right then, a tier above the tier you just went to partners. So I think that was key for us.
And how did you measure that success for the case study? Was it different for different partners as you had those early ones? Was it always customer acquisition? Were there revenue goal awareness?
Sorry, did not mean to, interject. But for us, the goal, the KPIs, or what measures success, there's two types of measurements, right? There's a success, what is success for our platform versus what is success for the partner. And for us, it was always acquisition at the time. For the partner, it definitely varied. For some partners, it was just like, we just want our product sampled across X number of users with product insights. Okay, great. That's called like having product at certain venues during certain time periods and getting a survey from all the people who booked during that time and sharing those insights, right? Versus some are like, hey, we actually just want utilization, right? We have a community that we want to offer a tennis or pickleball offering because our customer is the tennis customer, and like, we want to retain them to form a deeper relationship with. So we want to see utilization, right? And those metrics definitely varied, especially I would argue in the earlier days, because you're doing more custom things in the earlier days to figure out as a company, what type of partnership are you going to want to do with further partners? Because again, not all partnerships are meant or like the ones that you want to execute that fit in your roadmap. So for us, a big thing is like, we needed end user acquisition and we want our court partners to have court utilization basically, right? And so if a partner just cares about metrics that really don't drive towards our metrics in any way or add any of that value after the first time, like, that is also a good filter for us to not pursue that type of offering or not even offer that capability to a partner, like a Wilson or like a Tory Burch.
Got it. So it sounds like you created a playbook almost with the early sort of, we'll call them test phase one partnerships with the smaller brands. And then you were able to apply it to these bigger brands. Has it gotten faster because of that to create new partnerships now?
Yes, it definitely has. And I think that language exactly is it. We were really on a mission to create the playbook on what will we do versus what won't we do. And so, yeah, I would say just in general, like, that playbook is super integral to being able to create in order to create speed and right economies of scale as you're continuing to grow with larger partners. So a playbook is key because it definitely it creates a lot more speed and velocity as you start to scale that playbook out.
So in those early days, you were the playbook, right? You were the one going out to all the partners. How has that evolved over time?
Yeah. So going into the seed round, to the point we started this in the angel round, the pre-seed, it was when it was just me, myself, and I, but being able to have that playbook was really key for us, I would argue, raising that seed round so that we could bring on salespeople or partnership leads to take the playbook and now go at that higher velocity with larger partners.
Yeah, that's great. Are there obstacles that you have consistently faced that you've had to work past in getting to a new partner or getting through that process of that collaborative consultative process to get to a point of building kind of something that works for both sides that you would like to share?
Yes, there definitely are hurdles and challenges, which is that with a B2B partnership, it is just a slower burn in general. It just is because there's so many stakeholders that have input into whether the partnership is going to happen or not. You have some person in the company that loves what you do and is almost like the internal champion for what you do. They still have to get stakeholder buy-in across usually many other stakeholders. And challenges are just the burn. There is a burn to B2B partnerships, especially the bigger they are, if that makes sense. But those challenges typically are not one that you can necessarily control. The only thing that you can control is being able to continue to show more traction along the way during that burn, basically, to whichever stakeholder you are working with, to be able to give them more almost like validators when they're bringing you up to their stakeholders that they need to get buy-in from. So I think that the challenges are just that it's a slow burn, and when you're a small company, you're competing against larger companies with these partners, basically.
So have you ever had a partner that you've just put a lot of time into and they're just like, No, after all this, yeah, you're too small. We can't work with you.
Yes and no. We've had, so I would say a big thing for us now, especially in the initial conversations, is we really try to gauge like the likelihood of conversion. And a big thing we always try to understand faster and sooner is what are the challenges that are going to be there. So a small example is if we go after a company or a company comes to us, and when a company, i.e. a stakeholder, some person in the company, like comes to you or vice versa, if they don't have a budget, right, to spend on a benefit or whatever the offerings you have are, and they don't seem like they've invested in that offering before too, like in those two data points, the likelihood of pushing on that is not something that we would push on as much as another partner that has a data point of them investing in something similar, maybe another category, and where they're like, we have a budget for this thing. So I think like those two things are like now qualifiers for us to figure out whether we're going to go deeper with that and right, put in all this effort, i.e. resources towards that sales process or not. But that being said, like how we had partners where we've spent, I would still say like a decent amount of time, and it was like, no. Yeah, we have. We've definitely had that, I would say, a few times, but I think we took those few times as learnings to be able to figure out faster whether to go further and deeper and faster with a partner versus not, and go along for that 3 to 6 month journey, essentially, of a sales process.
Yeah. I think that's really an interesting take, that it doesn't always work.
Yeah.
And it's not always easy, and it can take a long time. For yep. sure. So you mentioned two things that I think are already like great pieces of advice for founders who are thinking about this, which the LinkedIn thing is so interesting. And then creating the playbook with those early partnerships. Are there any other kind of pieces of advice that you think are critical that you would give to early stage founders who want to start partnering with brands and get to that point where they're partnering with those bigger brands that have big names?
I think a really big thing, and this is just for us, is that we had the benefit of also having a direct to consumer business and a product. And so in general, when you're small, and it's almost like a similar sales process as when you're fundraising, the more traction you have, the easier it is to sell. So whether it's in like, it, so if the partnership cycle is really long, like we would, the reason why we can't, like, didn't spend too much time with every single B2B partner is because we also have a consumer platform. And so for us, we don't need to create 20 decks, makes sense, throughout to continue that sales process. We can just show, hey, like we activated a new market, or we are seeing tons of growth in this part of our business. We're able to give insights from our consumer business or B2B partners. So I think in general, again, I know every business is really different, but I do think being able to have, if you're going through a long sales process, being able to have some level of traction with in a smaller business line or a smaller piece of kind of your business in general, whether it's a consumer business, whether it's a smaller B business, I think that's really key to being able to get these larger B2B partnerships when you're a small company, just like tactically, like having traction and able to come back with traction like every month with a B2B, like a larger B2B partner over time. So that when the time comes, as you're growing and they're seeing your growth, they've already had this relationship and they want to be a part of your growth story, essentially.
It's funny because that's the advice I give to founders when they're running a fundraising process, is run the fundraising process when, like, in that season or time where you know you're going to get a lot of growth. So you have a lot of good news to tell yep. investors over and over again as you're going through the process. So it sounds like that yeah. really works for you as well.
Yeah. And it's not easy. Like, I think I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's not easy to run all these processes, especially at the earliest stage. It wasn't easy. But I also think that B2B partners like want to work with hungry founders and like hungry agile people in general that can deliver on something that their big company just cannot deliver on because of all of the stakeholder involvement that exists within a big org. So yeah, I think that'd be my most like tactical advice for the early stage founder who's like trying to get into the B2B partnership space. That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think one other thing that I think is interesting too, is that you were probably also able to capture this moment where tennis had a moment during COVID as well. And it's just one of those sports that's naturally socially distanced. And I don't know, it feels like there's a lot going on in tennis and now pickleball and paddle and all, to your point, racket sports. It sounds like that piece too, of taking advantage, you mentioned take advantage of a small business line, but if you're seeing a trend that's applicable to your business, taking advantage of that could be really helpful as well.
Agreed, which I think comes down to just also another early stage founder advice I would say is following the data in general. So, right, if you follow the data, you're going to be able to pull out and tell the narrative that makes it the most compelling, right, to a B2B partner as well.
Yeah. Well, that's it for my questions. And thank you so much, Tricia, for sharing your stories, your advice, and the interesting tips that I probably wouldn't have thought of ahead of time. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the RetailX podcast. We'll have another new episode out shortly. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about RetailX Series, check out www.retailxseries.com for more information, including recordings of past events. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at RetailX Series. You could also learn more about me, find fundraising resources, or submit a pitch deck at www.redgiraffeadvisors.com. Thanks, and catch you next time.